Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. So, do you want marketing made simple? Shopify removes the guesswork with built-in tools that help you create, execute, and analyze all your online marketing campaigns. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/income. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome to another episode of Broadway Nation, the podcast that tells the remarkable story of how immigrants, Jews, queers, African Americans, and other outcasts invented the Broadway musical and how they changed America in the process. I'm David Armstrong, and I call this episode The Other Musicals of Meredith Willson. This episode is made possible in part through the generous support of Robert Braun, who is a producer-level member of our Broadway Nation Backstage Pass Club. Information on how you can become a member of the Backstage Pass Club can be found in the show notes for this episode on our website at www.broadway-nation.com. Thank you to Bob and all of our members for supporting the work of Broadway Nation. What you're about to hear is the second half of my recent conversation with Dominic McHugh, author of The Big Parade, Meredith Willson's Musicals from The Music Man to 1491. In part one, Dominic shared the amazing insights and discoveries that he made during his research into the development of Willson's first and most famous show, The Music Man. If you missed that episode, you may want to catch up with that before listening to this one. Today, we discuss Willson's two follow-up hits, The Unsinkable Molly Brown and Here's Love, and his heartbreaking failure, 1491. And of course, there's even more discussion of The Music Man, more comparing and contrasting it with West Side Story, as well as comparing the careers and output of Meredith Willson and Leonard Bernstein, some of which may send hardline Bernstein fans into a tizzy. Dominic and I even get into a bit of a disagreement on exactly when the golden age of Broadway ended. I think you'll enjoy it. Just one note before we begin. Meredith Willson is without a doubt one of the major exceptions to the central premise of this podcast. He was not Jewish, queer, black, an immigrant, or a child of an immigrant. No, along with George Abbott, Bob Fosse, and just a small handful of other key inventors of the Broadway musical, Meredith Willson is one of the exceptions that proves the rule. Here we go. I begin by asking Dominic what Meredith Willson does after The Music Man. How does he follow up on this giant, giant hit?
One of his ideas was to write a sequel to it, The Son of the Music Man, which again, I found fascinating that he was so invested in the life of this work that he tried to create more of it. And indeed, it wasn't really that related to the original Music Man, although it's called The Son of the Music Man, but it's got sort of elements of the same kinds of figures in it. So that's one of the things he tried to do and then abandoned the idea. He just explored lots of things, as far as I can see, and ended up with The Unsinkable Molly Charlie Brown, which is interesting partly because he was just coming on board with a project that already existed. The book by Richard Morris already existed in some form. Other people had been approached. Irving Berlin, Burton Lane had been considered for Molly Brown before him. So all of that is a bit curious. When he'd written the biggest hit of the year, you'd think he would be very choosy and maybe wanting to write something else bespoke, something else original. But I think that the stress of spending all those years writing the book meant that he was ready to just write music and lyrics. He got on very well, as far as I can see, with Richard Morris, the book writer of Molly Brown. And I think it's a pretty good show. And personally, I don't think it needs fixing. I think it's a pretty serious and entertaining piece, but clearly it's not on the same sort of high plane as Music Man. But I'd love to just see a traditional production of it, because I reckon it'd be pretty fun.
I have seen it, actually. I've seen it in Summerstock. Mm-hmm. And I also saw the revised version of it that they did just a few years ago, which I thought was not as good as the original, even with some of the limitations of the original. I feel like it's three quarters of a good show. When you sit down to see it, it doesn't quite add up. But I was interested to see you go through the various versions of the show. And it seemed like there was some earlier versions that might have worked better than the version they ended up with, especially with the framing device of the Titanic.
Yeah, and a really fun idea, the idea that you start in the lifeboat with Molly saying, I'm going to tell you the story of my life. And then the whole thing becomes more framed as a tale rather than watching biography. The other thing that I think would have helped is just that Molly disappears a bit vocally in the second act. She had this big song called One Day at a Time. It's a really good song, a really big number. And I think Tammy Grimes couldn't cope with it. He was playing Molly in the original production, and so they got rid of it. I think if she'd had that moment of sort of musical articulation in the second act, that maybe that would lift it somewhat. Because the scenes in the second act actually read very well on the page. It becomes quite serious drama, but it's not working so well as a musical. The role of the music tends to be a bit more incidental. It lacks the sort of Till There Was You kind of moment. But this song could have done it. So I think if I were to revive The Unsinkable Molly Brown, I would maybe put the framing device back in that song, and maybe one or two other little bits and pieces. But otherwise, I think it's a fun musical comedy. It is generic. I think that's the main issue with it that I can see. It's all a bit too familiar, the bits and pieces.
Seems a little reminiscent of Annie Get Your Gun and other shows that we've seen before, and possibly better shows.
Yeah.
But as you say, it has some terrific material in it.
Drink when you're all alone or with somebody else.
Belly up to the bar, boys, better have a few more.
Never were with a three-toed girl or discontented.
Horrible example, like the girl whose name was Carrie. She carried a charm to everybody else, but her I had to marry or die, die, die.
Had to marry, marry or die, die, die.
One of the issues is, does he start to repeat himself in this? And is that a good thing or a bad thing? You go into that in the book from both perspectives.
Yeah, I think there was a pressure on him to repeat himself. And at the same time, the things that he had developed in The Music Man had worked well for him. So why wouldn't he? Rodgers and Hammerstein do the same things again and again and again in their shows. And indeed, several big Rodgers and Hammerstein songs were actually written for other shows, like Getting to Know You was actually written for Cable to sing in South Pacific, all the rest of it. I don't blame him for doing it.
I ain't down yet.
You're down, Molly. Holler, Uncle.
I ain't never shouting Uncle to you and nobody, because I ain't never down.
Come on, Molly, you're tuckered. Why don't you quit?
Sure, I'm tuckered and I might give out. But there'll come a time when nothing, no nobody, wants me down like I wants me up. Up where the people are, up where the talking is, up where the joke's going on. Now, looky here, I am important to me. Ain't no bottom to no pile. I mean much more to me than I mean to anybody I ever knew. Certainly more than I mean to any Siwash Yazzie hampers like you guys. Go ahead, break my arm. Me say Uncle, hoot! Doesn't make a bit of difference for you to keep saying I'm down till I say so too. Did you ever try stepping on a piss ant? Well, there's one now. Jumping, stumping, thinking you got him, thinking he's quit. He don't think so. There he goes. And you can be positive, sure I'm as good as any piss ant that ever lived. Oh, I hate that word down. But I love that word up, because up means hope, and that's just what I got.
But sometimes it's a bit, well, Molly sings a bit like Harold Hill and a lot of this rhythmic dialogue. Counterpoint numbers again, which are fun, but it's the sort of same sort of trick.
Okay.
So it is a bit like plus 50%, or maybe it's only 50% of the Music Man or something that is lacking a bit in individual musical expression. And things that are different are actually the more operatic moments where he's writing these things for Johnny.
Said goodbye and walked away. Walked away from all I know. From the sky and the trees and the snow-capped mountains. Said goodbye and left forever. Left my door, turned out my light. Left my friends, these stormy weather friends of mine, a hood string along, whether wrong or right. Oh, I could say goodbye to many things.
It's quite musically and harmonically complex, but at the same time, that takes us very much backwards, more into the Bernstein territory, actually. It's more like Tony or something singing in this very legit kind of style. But I have sympathy for him. As you say, what on earth do you do when you've written a show that everyone raves about as much as that? And the competition was West Side Story. The competition was Gwen Verdon in Redhead. The competition was so many big performers. You could go to see Lena Horne in Jamaica while the Music Man was playing, and yet you wanted to go and see the Music Man. It's a curious situation. Mary Martin was on Broadway. Ethel Merman was on Broadway. And yet people were flocking to see the Music Man still, which reminds us of the impact of that. But how on earth could he live up to it? I really don't know. It's the My Fair Lady problem again, as in Camelot could never live up to My Fair Lady, whatever it did.
Even if it hadn't had its challenges, it still would have been not My Fair Lady.
But there's a confidence problem, isn't there, with both of them, with Lerner and Lowe and with Wilson writing those follow-up projects. They're not so sure-footed. They both had production problems. Clearly, Wilson didn't get on with Dorrie Sherry, who was the director of Molly Brown, and that was a problem for the book writer too. Wilson and Morris were very clearly against Sherry, and so maybe a different director would have brought the thing in a better form. And similarly, we know with Camelot that everyone either died or nearly died along the way. It's a bit of a problem. But still, there is something about neither show went into rehearsal properly finished in the right form to just play. Whereas Fair Lady, apart from one scene, there were relatively few, there were changes, but they weren't big changes. And the same with Music Man. The odd song went in and out, but basically it opened and it was great.
It was ready to go.
It was ready to go.
Stay away, Molly. Please stay away. 'Cause I could never say goodbye to you. Again.
Don't go away. Broadway Nation will be back right after this short break. Hi, this is David Armstrong, and even here in Seattle, warmer, sunnier days are on their way. So it's time to fuel up for them and meet your wellness goals with Factor's No Prep, No Mess meals. Thanks to Factor's menu of chef-crafted meals with options like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, Keto, or my favorite, Vegetarian, Factor's fresh, never-frozen meals are dietitian-approved and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. So no matter how busy you are, you'll always have time to enjoy nutritious, great-tasting meals. So what are you waiting for? Kickstart that new healthy routine with 35 different meals and more than 60 add-ons to choose from every week, so you'll always have new flavors to explore. And you can crush those wellness goals with dietitian-approved meals and ingredients that you can trust. Make every day delicious from breakfast to dessert with restaurant-quality meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, and blackened salmon, with no shopping, prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. With Factor, you enjoy effortless support for your lifestyle, choosing from 6 menu preferences that help you manage calories, maximize protein intake, avoid meat, or simply eat well-balanced meals. Here's what you do. Head to factormeals.com/BN50 and use code BN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month. That's code BN50 at factormeals.com/BN50, as in Broadway Nation 50, and you'll get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month while your subscription is active. Do it today.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Now, I've seen many, many productions of The Music Man, and I've seen Molly Brown at least twice, I think. But I've never seen a production of Here's Love.
Ooh.
And
I've seen two.
Oh, wow.
I win.
You win. You absolutely win. You win the Meredith Wilson sweepstakes. This show has many more challenges than mm-hmm. Molly Brown, although for the first time, it's based on an existing source, which you think, if we look at the history of the Broadway musical, that makes things easier to start with an existing source. But in this case, it didn't work out.
And a great source, Miracle on 34th Street. What a great movie. It has musical written all over it. And you kind of think if MGM had tried to turn it into a musical with a score by Hugh Martin in 1948, then probably it would have been a great musical, that sort of thing. But the problem was that by the 1960s, Broadway had really started to change. There was a sense that it needed to be brought up to date. And Wilson, I think, was quite right in thinking that if you're going to do a good adaptation, it needs to bring something new to the table. There needs to be a reason to do it. I think of the famous Sondheim complaint about My Fair Lady gilding the lily, that Sondheim thinks that Pygmalion was great enough, why bother with the music kind of thing. Having identified this problem, I think Wilson thought, we need to make changes. And unfortunately, almost all of the instincts were wrong. Although, again, there were big production problems. I think that he lacked collaborators that could really steer him in a creative direction. And I was struck by a number of really good songs that were cut before they even went into rehearsal that illustrate moments in the story that aren't in Here's Love as it finally stands. It's an interesting conundrum.
That must be fascinating to go back into the archives and discover these songs that you are the only person who's heard in however many, 50 years. That's even aware that these songs exist, and to then go, well, that would make the show so much better if that song had survived to Broadway.
Yeah, it is. It can be frustrating, although I've done a number of concerts with my students at the university here in Sheffield over the years where we've looked at a particular show or several shows and actually played songs that were cut from them, and they always satisfy my brain, at least, to be able to hear them and play them once. We did some from The King and I a couple of years ago. We did a whole concert of cut songs from The Music Man, which is really interesting. And some of them aren't so good, but there's a really good one for Tommy and Zanita called Fireworks, for example. If you really wanted to make a change to The Music Man, I would stick Fireworks in just to kind of give them some musical moment of their own. You could just do a snippet version of it. The Mayor had a song called The Think System, which was a bit of a silly little thing, quite short. But again, I would love to just see it stuck back in the show and think, oh, well, audiences could have some surprise. The most recent revival of Hello Dolly began the second act with Penny in My Pocket. People loved just encountering something new in this incredibly traditional production of a very familiar show. I think there is scope to do stuff around that.
We didn't talk about Tommy and Zanita earlier, but I'm glad you brought it up. They are the second couple in the show, but their part got reduced down to basically dance roles, which works very well. But I'm hoping that in this new production, they will play up the cultural issues that are happening there. Tommy is named Gilles on purpose because it's some kind of Eastern European immigrant community. The immigration story of The Music Man between Mrs. Peru and the Gilleses, who are all outcasts by this community, is part of what's wrong with this community, but that rarely gets noticed. It's there, but people don't really notice it.
Yes, it's the equivalent of the West Side Story stuff, which is another commonality with West Side Story. And yes, Wilson was clearly very much aware of this stuff, but I guess they're usually played in such a cutesy way. And the idea that Tommy even has a family usually gets kind of lost. He's just a kid like all the other kids in the show, and there's no sense of him having an identity. But you're quite right, it would not be that difficult to stage it in a way that would beef that up and maybe address people's concerns about the landscape of the show and who these characters are.
Yeah, they're two star-crossed lovers that fall in love during a dance at the gym.
Sounds familiar.
Here's Love is a hit, however. In the literal definition of what makes a hit on Broadway, it pays back. It's interesting because you describe it as much more entertaining than my perception of it is, which is great because you know much more about it than I do. But I think we view it as sort of a failure, and it was not really that.
Well, it didn't fail. I think there are casting issues about the original production, that the people in it were not very exciting. The star is Janice Paige, who's the only really big name in it, and she's vocally past her best by this stage. And you can hear on the cast album, she really doesn't sound great. I think it's a bad cast album, in my opinion. It's badly recorded. The performances aren't very compelling. And so you really notice the things in the lyrics, for example, that are not up to scratch. I did see it a couple of years ago here in the UK in Liverpool at the Everyman Theatre. And I was really struck by how well the second act plays, actually, that the court scene and all of that business is really fun. The audience really responded to this moment where Macy stands up and says that man over there is Santa Claus and does it in song, which is different from the film.
That man over there is Santa Claus, I know, I know, I know. I can tell by the crinkle on the bridge of his nose, the wink of his eye, on the twinkle of his toes, and the joy wherever he goes. That man is he.
Makes song have some kind of purpose in the show. I think in general the show is lacking that kind of purpose, but it wasn't a flop, and Richard Kiley took over later on. Lisa Kirk was in it, and I imagine they would have been more exciting people. They would have probably sold it better than the initial leads. It was maybe one of those things that needs a refresh, and I would stick one or two songs back in and maybe revisit one or two things in the book, but I think it's something that actually could be quite fun.
I can tell by the crinkle on the bridge of his nose, the wink of his eye and the twinkle of his toes,
and
the
joy wherever he goes.
That man is he.
It must have suffered because of She Loves Me being on around the same time, another Christmassy show based on, or at least partly based on, a classic film that everybody knew. And of course, She Loves Me does it in such a clever way. In fact, it's more like The Music Man, as in the use of music is so unusual in She Loves Me, and His Love is much more conventional. That's clearly a bit of an issue.
It seems like Wilson is getting more traditional. He's in his 60s now, I'm assuming. For me, the most fascinating part of your book was the discussion of the playbill note or the program note that he wrote for Here's Love, and then Stephen Sondheim's response to that. How did you discover that? And tell us a little bit about your approach to that.
Yeah, so Wilson wrote this piece which appeared in newspapers and then was reproduced in the playbill for Here's Love called Evil Times. In it, he says, evil times have befallen the theatre. Let's get back to the good old days. Entertainment has become a dirty word. All of this kind of thing. So very reactionary and quite pointed. This was not consistent with his character in the 1950s, where he was much more pushing the envelope himself. And then Sondheim wrote a response to it and sort of said, actually, the evil times that fall in the theatre are that people like Meredith Wilson keep reproducing themselves and trying to do the same thing again, that they're not fresh anymore. And, you know, what are these good old days that you're referring to? Where Wilson was trying to say how wholesome Shakespeare was, and Sondheim says, well, have you seen Richard II? And have you seen Hamlet? You know, what's wholesome about them? Suddenly, Wilson is definitely at odds with the culture, and Sondheim becomes the man much more of the day. But those cuttings of those articles were in Wilson's archive. They were at the Great American Songbook Foundation. I just found them in a scrapbook along with it all. So it's interesting he kept them.
And of course, Sondheim has been a champion of Wilson as being an innovator and talks about he's one of the first people to use rap in a theatrical concept before there is rap and how groundbreaking it was. But it does seem like Wilson is starting to, and this is maybe natural with people as they age. Also, I do feel like all the writers of that generation were feeling like they were under attack and under assault, and the world was changing around them in a way that they didn't understand. What year is this?
Here's Love, 1963.
1963. So still fairly early. The golden age, in my mind, is still going strong. I view the cutoff as Hair, basically, because I think we go through Hello, Dolly and all those golden age shows. other aspects and avant-garde start coming into the Broadway musical with Man of La Mancha and things like that. But still, I feel like that golden age tradition just goes right up to the end of the 60s. Other people see it differently. We haven't gotten to the age of rock yet, really. Elvis is around, but it's not really affected Broadway by any chance.
Oh, I disagree. I think it has affected Broadway. It's affected Broadway because Broadway music is very much not the pop music of the day. That is why it isn't so much the golden age for me in this 60s period you're describing. It's because actually, suddenly the whole thing has shrunk in impact and in relevance. Whereas this was the stuff that was in everyone's homes in the 1950s, suddenly, actually, it's not what everyone is listening to anymore. If you think about, was it 1954 when all four main TV channels broadcast that Rodgers and Hammerstein TV special with all the scenes from all the original casts? You can't imagine that happening in the 60s in the same way. And that is the shifting culture. And to me, the golden age is about this sort of, the avant-garde is there, but in populist form in the 50s. And by the 60s, it's hard for me to see Hello Dolly as avant-garde, even though I love it. I don't think Funny Girl is avant-garde. And it's also a bit 60s musically. You know, it has this slight Vegas aspect in songs like Don't Rain on My Parade. It's become poppy in a way that we didn't tend to see in the 50s. To me, everything has shifted. And as you say, we've got people in crisis. Frederick Lowe retires, Hammerstein dies, Rodgers tries to team up with Sondheim and it doesn't go well. You know, Stein manages to keep going, which is quite unusual, but almost everyone has given up. That funny bridging generation of Jerry Herman and Buck and Harnick, they weren't around for very long, really. They didn't write shows of the style of the moment for very long. And to me, it's not like Sondheim in the 70s or even Lloyd Webber, who I'm not a fan of, but you can see that there's that Lloyd Webber time. I don't think that Bock and Harnick and Herman ever had really an innovative time, even though I really, really like their shows. For me, there is a clear point of articulation. Things are beginning to decay at the end of the 50s with the failure of Camelot, with the fact that The Sound of Music is just not anything like Oklahoma and Carousel or South Pacific in terms of ambition and innovation. So rant
over. Interesting. Yeah. Of course, I was a child in the 1960s, so I view it from a slightly different perspective because one after another of those giant hit movie musicals came out, all Broadway shows. So my childhood in those years was made up of The Music Man and My Fair Lady and The Sound of Music and all the others. Oliver, that is the 1960s to me. And then the record cabinet in my parents' house of Hello Dolly and Fiddler on the Roof. And that was dominating the culture to a great extent. Not that rock and roll wasn't there as well. And of course, by the time we get to the Beatles coming in, but even they're recording Till There Was You.
Just one.
But still, it got there.
That was not a major record, though.
No, but it was on a major record.
It was.
There was love all around, but I never heard it singing. No, I never heard it at all. Till there was you, till there was you.
Let's go on to talk about 1491, which is the saddest part of your book, I have to say, but fascinating. That really is a sort of heartbreaking slog as he tries to get this thing to happen. One more show in his 70s at this point.
Yeah, poor old Meredith. It's a shame that, as far as I'm aware, there's no film of the production available, unless there might be one hidden away somewhere, but I've never seen a film because I do think that the highlight of it was probably the sets. I've heard live audio recordings of it, and you can hear people applauding when the scene changes because it's so amazing. Oliver Smith, the designer of My Fair Lady and West Side Story, but more than a decade on and doing more amazing things. The show, unfortunately, had two problems. One is it was a terrible idea. It's a show about Columbus's preparations to go and find the New World. He's not even really sailing away or doing all those violent things that he did. He's just doing the conniving things in the background in preparation for it. That is not a great topic for a Broadway musical, and very much counter to the civil rights movement, which was very much underway by this point. You know, framing Columbus as this attractive hero, as a kind of Harold Hill kind of figure, and someone that can be maybe redeemed through love. This is a terrible idea. And this is why the show is not revivable, because it's an offensive idea. But the other problem was that everybody died. So it was a bit like Camelot for Wilson. Ed Ains, the guy that had brought him the idea of the show, died. Frank Lesser, his mentor, died. His second wife died. And so he was facing a lot of bereavement while trying to develop this thing. And I guess it must have been difficult to manage him. And in addition, the whole thing was kind of a bit more classical. The score is really, really interesting. It's unusual, innovative. It really doesn't sound like The Music Man. Ed Lester, the producer, started campaigning to try and get him to write numbers that were more like The Music Man, which is an interesting piece of documentation in that it's not Wilson wanting to sound like 76 Trombones, it's the man in charge of the money. But the style of the thing is just so far apart now from things like Hair and all of those late 60s shows, Sweet Charity, even Cabaret. It's too operetta-ish. It's style and configuration. In a funny way, it doesn't sound that old-fashioned when you listen to it. It's in a funny zone. It's not commercial in any way. And I think some scenes went down well. Cheetah Rivera is playing the sort of girlfriend, the lover. You can hear she gets a big hand on all the recordings. But I think even then that the idea of the show is not that attractive to people. And the reviews are terrible. There are one or two reasonable reviews, but it did not go down well. It never even made it to Broadway, and it's all very sad. And because of the subject matter being so impossible, it's sad to think that his final show can't even be saved. You wouldn't even want to put it on at Musicals in Mufti or somewhere so we can just see what this thing is like. In my view, it shouldn't be aired, but we should talk about it. Some of the songs could be.
I was going to say, are there songs that should be, yeah, should be brought forward?
Definitely. A number of them. We need a new Meredith Wilson songbook, but no one's publishing songbooks anymore. But if that were to happen, then we could publish some of the songs, and then at least we could hear some of this thing.
And the show only played in California.
Correct.
As part of the Los Angeles Civic Light Opera, which is something that most people don't even know happened, but it was quite a big deal for many years. And that's also where Kismet, another show that's hard to revive, and Song of Norway came from. They had a tradition of bringing shows from there to Broadway.
Correct. And vice versa, that Lester would bring big Broadway shows to the West Coast. So My Fair Lady was part of the same season as 1491, and it would have been some version of the original sets and quite, you know, a really classic My Fair Lady. It was advertised with the Hirschfeld caricature, all the rest of it. They were used to seeing quality. If I remember correctly, I think there was a revival of Annie Get Your Gun with Debbie Reynolds and really high quality, big Hollywood names performing this stuff. So it was a big gig and a big deal. And it was a subscriber theater. So people would buy seats a bit like encores for all three shows in the season or however many productions they were doing. So it ought to have been a great place to do this, but sadly not.
And like most artists, it's hard to give up. It's hard to stop. Wilson toys around with a few more ideas. Mm-hmm. What were those ideas?
I can't even remember them all off the top of my head, but the one that's memorable is Dennis the Menace, the cartoon strip. He spent a number of years looking at that, and he was petitioned by the cartoonist to consider doing that. But we were in the 1970s by now. Wilson doesn't need the money, the hassle. Although he contemplated three or four projects, all of them, it was just a few conversations is my understanding of the situation. And he was much more interested actually in developing his legacy and associating more with The Music Man, because it was such a long time since he'd had a major hit by the 1970s. He would do more and more interviews around The Music Man. I think his sister probably played quite a big role in giving him the initial ideas or working up the initial ideas for The Music Man with him. And she died. I think when she died, he became more and more comfortable, basically implying that The Music Man was something that happened to him, as if it sort of passed through him passively, something like that. It is a shame, but it was clearly time for him to quit. You can see why he wouldn't want to have another 1491, and what could he do? It was the same problem for Richard Rodgers, who similarly really struggled in the 1970s, and for that matter, Alan J. Lerner had a great revival of My Fair Lady in 1976, and a terrible time with 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. His new show with Leonard Bernstein ran a week. They were all struggling, despite coming up with really interesting work and having actually quite good ideas, but it wasn't their time anymore. And that's how popular culture works, unfortunately.
And as you point out, unlike those others, Wilson only had one show really to look back on. He didn't have this canon of shows as a claim to fame.
Absolutely. And Frank Lesser pointed this out to him. I think Wilson was ready to quit after Here's Love, and he should have done, simply because he'd had enough and he had this huge career. Is that not enough? But Frank started having a go at him and saying, goodness me, you need a body of works, because even though Harold Rome is so much more mediocre compared to you and your talent, people respect Harold Rome because he's written 15 shows or whatever and has this big body of work. You need a body of works. So then he embarks on 1491 and it somewhat sank.
I think Lesser was correct, and you point this out in the book. Now we only remember The Music Man. We don't remember any of that incredible career that he had prior to The Music Man. That kind of career doesn't last, doesn't linger in your mind. So we look at him as a one-hit wonder, even though he was, or a one-and-a-half-hit wonder, however you want to say it, two. Let's give him two.
I think, but if we can count Wonderful Town, then I think we can count The Unsinkable Molly Brown, Frank.
I'll agree with you there. So he's a two-hit wonder, and yet it's really unfair because he was a major force in show business for 55 years before the first of those hits. But it was on the radio. I mean, the radio was something we just don't remember, even as an incredible cultural force that it was. It's disappeared entirely. So that's interesting how perceptive Frank Lesser was in looking forward when he sort of gives that pep talk to Meredith Wilson.
Frank Lesser was so amazing. I find it curious, though, that Wilson's work on The Great Dictator and The Little Foxes is forgotten, because those are two really big films, and they remain films that are canon, basically. They're not forgotten films, they're not minor films. He only worked on two films, and they were major for completely different reasons, and his contributions to them are distinctive. People go on a lot about the role of music in The Great Dictator, for example. Well, he was making it all happen, even if Charlie Chaplin was coming up with a lot of the ideas. It's funny how people manage to appreciate Bernstein in all his many facets. It's the thing that's admired about Bernstein is the Young People's Concerts and Omnibus and West Side Story and the symphonies and MASH.
And we hear about On the Waterfront. We hear about his film score.
Exactly. And yet, poor old Meredith, people don't go on about his symphonies. I think the first one is actually quite good, the second one less so. But then Bernstein's symphonies aren't that amazing, in my view. His symphonic work is patchy, let's say, which you can also say about Wilson. Clearly, Bernstein is this titanic figure, but then when you look at the details, actually, Wilson has so many of the same assets in his career and a lot of success. And he moved on at the right time with most of it. 1491 is the big mistake, really, because apart from his dreadful novel, Who Did What to Fidelia? But most of what he did was really successful. It's bewildering. How do you have a life like that?
Well, you have helped to set the record straight very much with this really amazing book. What's next? Are you working on something new?
The main thing I'm working on is a book about the film, The Bandwagon. I'm editing a new series of books for Oxford on film musicals. They're going to be sort of short books, affordable books. There isn't a lot of literature on film musicals compared to Broadway. I've got a colleague who's written a book about Love Me Tonight that's coming out, 1932, Maurice Chevalier, Rosen Hart. Someone's writing about La La Land at the moment, has interviewed all the creatives. I'm doing The Bandwagon based on archival research out of that.
All-time favorite movies, The Bandwagon.
It's great.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for talking with us today on Broadway Nation.
Thank you so much for reading the book in so much detail and so reflectively. These have been amazing questions, and I really appreciate them. The depth of your engagement with it. It's great to be reminded of the book because, of course, I finished it last year now. Reflecting back on it is really interesting.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure. Thanks again to Dominic McHugh, whose recent book is The Big Parade, Meredith Wilson's Musicals from The Music Man to 1491. I highly recommend it. Interestingly, the movie The Bandwagon will come up again on the next episode of Broadway Nation, when my guest will be Kevin Winkler, who is the author of Everything is Choreography, The Musical Theater of Tommy Tune. It's a fascinating book as well, and I hope you will join us. Broadway Nation is written and produced by me, David Armstrong. If you love this podcast and want to delve even deeper into the world of Broadway musicals, I invite you to become a member of the Broadway Nation Backstage Pass Club. For as little as $7 a month, members will receive exclusive access to never-before-heard, unedited versions of every Season 2 interview and many from Season 1 as well. I often record at least twice as much conversation as ends up in the public episodes, and this includes additional in-depth conversations with my frequent co-host, Albert Evans. You will also have the opportunity to ask us any questions about Broadway musicals that you would like to hear answered, and to propose topics and subject matter that you would like me to cover, all of which I will incorporate into a special series of Ask Me Anything About Broadway episodes. Last, but certainly not least, you will receive special on-air shout-outs and acknowledgement of your vital support for this podcast. To join, just click the link included in the show notes for this episode on our website at www.broadway-nation.com. That's broadway-nation.com. Special thanks to Pals Mox for his help with editing this episode, to KVSH 101.9, the voice of beautiful Vashon Island, Washington, and to the entire team at the Broadway Podcast Network.
Why is
wondered how your favorite performer actually feels? Well, here's your chance. Welcome to The Quiet Part Out Loud with me, Bobby Steggert, Broadway actor and now a therapist to a whole host of Broadway creatives. Part interview, part therapy, this is not your typical podcast. We'll go right to the heart of things with some of your favorite artists, what they still struggle with, what lessons they've learned, what they haven't figured out yet. There's enormous power in saying the quiet part out loud. Are you listening?
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.